Welcome to Curated Conversations from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, bringing you the best events each week from the world's number one defense and national security think tank. To explore the hundreds of events we host each year, visit us at csis.org.
Kurt Yeager, we are absolutely delighted to bring focus on a topic that unfortunately doesn't receive the attention it deserves. It is a crisis that affects upwards of, according to the United Nations, 40 million people across 165 countries. 71% of those affected are women and girls. It is a challenge that is also a criminal enterprise. According to the International Labor Organization, it is $150 billion per year criminal activity. It has been called the greatest human rights issue of our time by an assistant to the president, Ivanka Trump. It is called modern slavery. Slavery is defined as someone who's held against his or her will or otherwise forced to work through violence or threats of violence or abuse of authority. It has been described as a complex crime that encompasses slavery, servitude, forced and compulsory labor, and human trafficking. And here is another underreported fact. One of the leading intellectual forces behind ending modern slavery is the man that's sitting beside me. Two-term senator from Tennessee, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, an active member of the Banking and Budget Committee, who has led a multi-year effort to shine a light on slavery, Senator Bob Corker. Thank you so much, Senator, for joining us. We have an exceptional opportunity to talk to you about your efforts to this. You have visited over 70 countries in your work on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Take us back to a visit you took in 2014 to Southeast Asia. You met with a group of women and girls who had been victims of trafficking. Start us there and tell us how you became so involved and focused on this incredible crisis that we're just not talking about.
Well, thank you. First, am I on?
You were on, sir.
I mean, the mic's working.
Your mic's yeah. on, exactly.
First of all, thank you for hosting this. This is a topic that needs further highlighting, yet a lot of progress has been made. And I want to thank the ambassador for being here. I met with the prince when he was in town recently and know of what you and your country are doing to work on the financial control side of it. The $150 billion has to make its way through financial institutions, and I know that you and many others who care about this issue are working very hard on this, your country. So thank you so much, and again, CSIS for hosting. So I'm going to go back a little bit further to answer the second part of your question. I knew nothing about modern slavery. I knew a little bit about human trafficking. Am aware of the numbers. You say 40 million. There are some estimates that are 27 million. But the point is, there's more slavery today in the world than at any time in the world's history. I found out about this in a very odd way. Our chief of staff, Todd Womack, who's in the back of the room, goes down from time to time to Hilton Head with his family, four kids, and his wife, and he passed through Atlanta to a church called Passion Church that meets in a Home Depot. It's one of these large new churches that has an outstanding minister named Louis Giglio. And in passing through, he became aware of what was happening with modern slavery. I think in one of those meetings, Gary Haljan at IJM spoke and talked about some of the stats and some of the numbers, and then interestingly, passing back through again 6 months later, a year later, the minister said in talking about this issue, Louis Giglio, if not you, who? And so anyway, you know, that kind of hits you. I'm in a position that Tennesseans and many of you have allowed me to be in where I can affect things like this. We had IJM come in and make a presentation. I read a book and other materials about what was happening. And as you know, I travel the world extensively, most of the time going to places that are pretty yucky because that's where we have problems. But over time, as you mentioned, 75 or 6 countries. On a Southeast Asia trip, We stopped in the Philippines for the sole purpose of meeting with victims of slavery, hearing their stories, but also meeting with the local police there to find out what they were doing to change the culture within the police department to actually prosecute, to find out how you deal with victims after, because let's realize, you know, these, what they're up against is people who have dominion over them, right, and have the ability to have the ability to make their lives miserable, to basically kill them, to do whatever if they're testifying against people who have them in this situation. Another stat that's helpful, I think, is 24% of the slavery that exists in the world is sexual servitude. And so when you talk about the stats of over 70% being women and children, that stat obviously jumps out. And then the rest is things like day labor. Hard labor, working in brick kilns, rug manufacturing. In Ghana, it's young boys who are in the fishing industry. And so again, once you see that there are mechanisms and ways of dealing with this, and of course once you hear from victims, one story, two girls, 13 and 15, sisters, were in one of the rural areas of the Philippines. A man comes by and says, hey, how would y'all like to go to the capital? How would you like to go visit for the day? I'll bring you back this evening. And of course, one of them ends up in a brothel in Malaysia for 9 years. Family disowns them because of just the culture of having been in this trade, abducted and in this trade and finally escaping. And so anyway, when you see what is happening and then you realize there are numbers of efforts that are taking place around the world, what's happening in the country that's hosting, we meet with many people around the world, and you see that there are lots of efforts by really well-meaning people, but there's not a central effort to say, let's end this scourge on mankind. Think about the fact that each year people come into our office, or were coming into our office, and they were asking for incremental help. You know, John Tanner's here, used to serve in Congress. He was an appropriator, I think. And he knows what it's like. People come in each year and they ask for a little bit more money to help with an effort. But that doesn't create the effort to end it. So then think about PEPFAR and think about what the world community has done to attack HIV in a world effort that's not here just to deal with it, but to end it. Think about that and apply it to what is happening with slavery. So we, over the last several years, and it's been much more difficult than I would have ever thought. Anything in Congress, as you know, today is difficult. But we, over the last several years, have been leading an effort to create a global fund to end modern slavery, just as I was referring to what happened with HIV and what is happening. And it's to use best practices to do so in a way that is measurable, so that you're not just throwing money at it, but you can measure the outcomes. You can measure the reductions in slavery that are taking place in a country. But also to do so in a way that's a public-private partnership, so it's sustainable, and so that you bring the world community together. A 501c3 has been set up here in Washington. To do this, it's set up a lot like the National Endowment for Democracy. We have an organizing board that's been in place for some time. We were able to get appropriations put in place, and this year, first of all, it's really kind of unfortunate. The appropriations part was easier than the authorization part. We finally were able to get it authorized so that people know that it's permanent and it's going to be in place. And thankfully, the State Department just approved the first $25 million tranche going into the End Modern Slavery Initiative, the Global Fund. UK, we've been meeting with Prime Minister May, who's been a leader on this issue. The Catholic Church is very involved also in the UK on this issue. She just has appropriated $25 million. Another individual soon, and I won't, until it happens, announce who, is getting ready to participate. And the way this will be funded, again, so that it has continuity and a long-term focus and effort, is the United States over 7 years will put up $250 million. There's another, by the way, $25 million tranche coming from the State Department very soon. But the United States will put up $250 million over a seven-year period. Other countries will put up $500 million to match it 2-to-1. And then the private sector, we're pursuing to match it on a 3-to-1 basis. And again, the first private sector contribution will be coming soon. This way, you're bringing the private community, the other countries together who will have board seats on this particular effort. And the United States, with its leadership role, we can focus on best practices. We can focus on making sure that these disparate efforts that are taking place around the world are able to come together, and we're able to utilize, again, the very best efforts that are taking place around the world. I'll stop because I know that was a long-winded explanation.
You gave an incredible description of exactly, this is an ambitious project. I mean, if all of those contributions, the $250 million from the U.S., the leveraging foreign $500 million, $750 million from the private sector, this is a $1.5 billion global fund with the ambitious goal of reducing slavery by 50%. I mean, that's
in the areas that we work in. So, you know, again, the metrics around this are very important to be able to measure in advance when you go in how much slavery is actually taking place there, and actually measure what is happening. Those attributes of this are important for its sustainability. One of the things about PEPFAR is we've been able to measure treatments and reduction. And what I found early on coming to the United States Senate is when there's a lot of money in place, everyone wants to glom onto it for other efforts. And so what you have to do, what we've had to do with PEPFAR is ensure that its mission remains pure, that the money is used for treatments, that it's not used for all kinds of other things that sound great but have nothing to do with reducing the prevalence of HIV. We've got to do the same thing here, and we believe by setting it up in this manner, Congress will keep its focus in the right place, but also the world community.
There's strong bipartisan support for this. You and Senator Cardin have led the bipartisan resolution that created the End Modern Slavery Initiative. I mean, that's really that's what makes this so vital. It has bipartisan support and priority, if it's been, you know, for the appropriation as well.
It has bipartisan support. I will say, very strong bipartisan support. No side of the aisle can claim ownership of. And actually, Bob Menendez, my good friend who was chairman of the committee prior to Ben Cardin's leadership, he actually began this with us. I mean, he was my partner in making this happen. Ben has stepped in and always been a fighter for human rights issues around the
Absolutely.
World, a tremendous partner. And we have numbers of people. You know, there are efforts that also are taking place within our own country. This is a sort of a foreign relations effort to bring the world community together around this issue. But we also have efforts that are taking place domestically, and Amy Klobuchar and Heidi Heitkamp and John Cornyn and Portman and others. So there are things that are happening with our own country. Look, in my home state of Tennessee, slavery exists. It does in 161 countries around the world. And slavery is outlawed in every country in the world. But there are young people in my own state right now that are in sexual servitude and trying to find a way out. And so this in no way diminishes. As a matter of fact, I think the two build together.
What creates the urgency? It's happening
right
here within the U.S.
If I could mention one other thing.
Please.
Here's the thing that, we got into this and I'm glad to be the vessel, if you will, through which much of this is happening. But it's our country that is behind this. I spoke yesterday in a church here in town with advocates who are coming to the Hill to raise awareness. These are supporters of IJM. There's so many other groups. There are country music stars. There are people around the country that are giving hugely of their own resources to cause this to end. One of the things that I hope elected officials will see is that the young people of our country, they find this to be something that is to them such a passion to overcome. It's amazing how I did not know of this. That, you know, as we've begun this, we've seen the tremendous support of young people, and so they're passionate about it. And just from the standpoint of causing young people to be a part of bringing out the best in our nation and world, recognizing that and tapping into that as we move ahead, I think is very, very important.
Senator, are you comfortable, Secretary Tillerson, in announcing the State Department's $25 million contribution? This is going to be the office at the State Department that oversees combating trafficking in persons and monitoring this. There have been some concerns, the State Department's lack of personal appointments and organization. Do you feel comfortable and confident that this office is geared to really be the driver that you need for this global initiative?
You're talking about the State Department.
The State Department, yes, sir.
Look, it appears from time to time, one of the few strong supporters of Rex Tillerson here. I think Rex, personally, I thought Rex was a inspired choice because of his background. Rex has been really, really supportive of this effort. You mentioned Ivanka. We've been over to see her multiple times, and I had been to the Vatican talking with them about this effort. The Catholic Church obviously cares deeply about this issue. Before her trip to the Vatican with the president, we had multiple meetings. They haven't, she cares about this issue, and certainly I think will play a role as it moves ahead, but there's no question the State Department is absolutely supportive of this. We could not have a better, actually, because they're new, and there was sort of an ownership issue when we began this. There was some resistance in the last administration, not towards dealing with this issue, okay, but towards setting something up like this that in some ways, let's face it, is outside of government. Rex has been tremendously supportive. We do hope to have someone in the TIP office soon.
Good.
And there's been some holdups there. We have had an outstanding individual for this particular post. We don't know, how that's going to pan out. But certainly having somebody in the TIP office that is supportive, I'm sure that will end up being the case. But I better stop. Look, the State Department could not have been a stronger supporter of this effort.
Absolutely. Really, really important. The United Nations has also been an important partner here in both the research. And in fact, I think, unfortunately, it was lost in President Trump's speech, where his message to the UN General Assembly, he had mentioned the Global Fund very specifically.
Yeah.
It was, unfortunately, overtaken by comments about North Korea. But, I mean, there is a strong UN role here that I think we also need to think about how multilateralism is really leveraging America's strong interest and leadership magnified.
There's no question, and we've had discussions with the UN. Actually, when he gave that speech, I was sitting in a hearing, and Ivanka actually texted me the video of him mentioning the Global Fund just to make sure I knew he mentioned
Good.
The Global Fund. So it was highlighted to me anyway.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that. Wish that we would have highlighted that a little bit. As you think about your own post-Senate life, do you see your continued active engagement in the Global Fund, in the campaign to end modern slavery? Is that something that you think will continue your efforts?
So I have no idea what my post-Senate life is going to be. I want to be involved as a person. You know, I came into this whole issue of being in the public arena because as a young businessman, I saw that we had a lot of people living in our community that did not have decent housing. I used to build shopping centers around the country. I started a business at a young age when I was 25. And by the time I was 28 or so, I knew that I was going to be a very well-off person unless I made some mistakes. And I ended up, for a lot of reasons, being involved in our inner city. And I saw that, again, there were so many people in our community that were living in housing that was not fit for your pets. And I met a guy named Jim Rouse, a very liberal Democrat from Columbia, Maryland, who raised my vision regarding this issue in an incredible way. And I led the creation of a nonprofit that ended up helping about 10,000 families in Chattanooga have decent, fit, and affordable housing. And it was that that a governor saw and asked me to serve on a board. And so I came into this arena by trying to address community needs, not as a politician who had been active, quote, in party activities. So when I leave here, I certainly hope to continue my involvement in issues that I care deeply about. There's a board that's been set up as it relates to the Global Fund. It'll expand. Someone from the UK will be coming on soon. My guess is this individual who's getting ready to be a part of this will likely come on. As to what I'm involved in the future, I just don't know, but certainly I do not plan to shrink away. I want to be involved in dealing with issues that affect people's lives.
It strikes me as you began this story, a story in some ways of serendipity, of hearing a pastor speak very strongly about this issue. It captured your heart. The faith-based community has played an incredible role. There's this wonderful photo of you, and I just want you to spend a moment explaining it. Standing at the Vatican with your palm stretched, there was a big red X on it. The End It campaign, February 23rd, is sort of a way to express that we want to end modern slavery. Tell me about that moment again, how you really are, that the faith, I think this is the PEPFAR story as well. Yep. It was an incredible growth of people wanting to serve neighbor in need and coming forward and turning that into action.
It is. The End It movement has been incredible as it relates to raising awareness. So that phase of this has been very important. That phase, by the way, is I think what captured young people's imagination around our country. I think that more than anything else has made them aware and wanted them to be involved. Of course, we've got to figure out a way to channel that. But the next step is after awareness, you've got to then do something about it. You've got to figure out a way to solve this issue, and that is the phase that we're in now. We're beginning. Resources are flowing. Other countries will join us in this effort. Liechtenstein is obviously already involved, and again, I think they would acknowledge by creating a vessel through which we can coordinate activities, working with other governments, we can even have greater impact. But no doubt, the Red X has raised people's awareness. Look, I raise it a slight amount, but when my buddy Peyton Manning puts it on, people really pay attention. And so Peyton has participated the last several years.
Awesome.
No doubt standing in front of the Vatican and doing that and knowing that of their tremendous concern, their power, Ashton Kutcher and I presented down at the Rotary International down in Atlanta. Again, if you ever want to feel not particularly special, do something with Peyton or do something with him, Ashton. But he has given of his personal resources to create a mechanism for law enforcement to interdict what is happening. It's very sophisticated. Interestingly, and just happenstance, a company in Tennessee actually has developed the software to make this happen. But Ashton, with his own resources, has created something called Thorn that officials all around our country can use for free. It allows them to use this technology for phone numbers. What happens with these young people that are in servitude, they end up having a phone when they go into, but that phone is a different phone. They keep giving them different phones because they don't want to be tracked down. And this, and so you can imagine a policeman. I know I'm getting off track, but a policeman just tracking with pencil numbers versus having this artificial intelligence, if you will, that can track all this down to a person in just a moment, in just a matter of seconds. Well, at Rotary International, we presented, and what we hope is going to happen, you know, Rotary International has done an incredible job fighting polio. There are only three countries in the world today that have polio outbreaks because of what Rotary International has done. So hopefully they're tuned into this. And what we're hoping that they are going to do is now take this on with great success, with the great success they've had with polio. But if you begin, again, bringing these civic organizations, absolutely, churches, countries, individuals with resources together, I really do think that, think about the millions and millions of people who have who others have dominion over. I mean, it can be a small business person in a village in Peru that knows that these young poor people have no access to justice, that can cause someone to be enslaved. That's what's happening around the world. I really believe that the world community, are on the verge of making even greater strides towards ending this.
Senator Corker, you have perfectly described what makes American leadership great. Thank you so much. You were speaking to a pastor's kid, so I'm going to tell you what was running through my mind as you were talking. To whom much is given, much is expected. And that's how you began your career. If not now, when? If not you, who? Was the motivating force behind this. And I recall the Book of Esther. You were placed here for a time such as this. Thank you. Thank you. We needed a little inspiration. And you've been experiencing an unrelenting news cycle the last 24 hours, and this was a good way for us to start our morning. Thank you so much for your leadership. Before I ask you all to join me in thanking Senator Corker, I'm going to give you a little bit of an instruction. We're going to escort Senator Corker out. He needs to get back to Capitol Hill, where he's got a very busy schedule ahead. We're going to invite our panelists up that are really going to take a deep dive into how to break down the financial, the criminal networks, how we can really fight the scourge of modern slavery. So I want you to stay right there as we do a little bit of a set change. But what a privilege it was to have you here with us today. And colleagues, would you please join me in thanking Senator Corker for a great discussion.
Thank you.
I direct the Human Rights Initiative here at CSIS. And it's my honor to moderate the next portion of today's program, in which, as Heather mentioned, we're really going to drive deeper into how to effectively combat human slavery and trafficking in persons, including using financial tools, which, as many of you know, is not oftentimes a part of the conversation. So here with me to dive a little bit deeper, we have two well-known experts. To my left is Daniel Telesclough, who is the director of the Financial Intelligence Unit of Liechtenstein, the chair of Monival, and the chair of the Egmont Technical Assistance and Training Working Group. He is a lawyer by profession and has over 20 years of experience dealing with anti-money laundering and anti-corruption work, including when he served as a member of the Swiss delegation to the Financial Action Task Force, FATF. And to his left is my colleague, Jennifer Cook, who directs the Africa program here at CSIS. In that role, she leads research and analysis on political, economic, and security dynamics in Africa. Some of her recent projects include an examination of militancy and extremism in the Sahel and Lake Chad Basin, looking at religious authority and the state in Africa, energy trends in sub-Saharan Africa, and the launch of the Spotlight in Africa series, which provides an in-depth look at political and economic developments in Africa's largest and most dynamic economies. So thank you for being with us, Daniel and Jennifer. Daniel, I want to start with you to just provide the audience and the people who are tuning in via the live stream with a better understanding of what is the role of financial institutions and regulators in combating human trafficking and human smuggling?
Sure. Well, let me first thank you for having us here. As you have seen, this is a tremendously important topic, and we're very grateful for you bringing together all these people to talk about it, and also to learn more about how we can tackle it in practice. Human trafficking, modern slavery is big business. We heard it in the introduction, $150 billion of revenues a year is enormous amount of money. But this also creates an opportunity because this amount of of revenues has to be administered, has to be moved around, has to be laundered, as we would say in criminal justice terms. And we have a full toolbox of instruments that we can use to tackle money laundering, well established, working for 20, 30 years now. But I think what we lack currently is a focus on modern slavery and to understand it as one of the major, what we call predicate offences to money laundering. We're pretty safe when we talk about corruption, fraud, tax fraud, and other issues, but I think there's a limited understanding of the importance of modern slavery. Because very often, if you look at the individual situation only, the amount of revenues wouldn't be that big. But because we're dealing here with, to a large degree, with criminal organizations, if you put that together, you actually come up with huge sums. And there's also another link, which you may be more familiar than me, is a link to terrorist organizations. We know from what we know about ISIL is that one of the sources of income for ISIL is modern slavery and human trafficking. So there is also an element of combating financing of terrorism in there. And this is why this should become extremely relevant for financial institutions. Because if you violate all these regulations about money laundering and terrorist financing, you will get into deep trouble. And this is why financial institutions are increasingly interested. And especially here in the US, large US banks, but also increasingly in Europe, banks are actually coming to us, regulators and public authorities, sit together and to better understand what is happening and to start engaging. And this is something very, very positive. We had an excellent gathering earlier this year at Grace Farms in Connecticut, where I think 100 people or so from regulators, law enforcement, NGOs, and financial institutions came together to explore ways how we can better tackle the money laundering aspects to modern slavery. Basically, the common theme was how to unlock financial chains of human trafficking, modern slavery. An excellent report. You can download it on the website of the CSIS also, has been produced. And there's a number of recommendations in it, very innovative. Let me just maybe highlight two or three of them. Basically, we grouped it into three main actions, areas of action. One is awareness raising among financial institutions. And again, some have already speeded up their efforts, but others are still pretty silent. So we need more case studies, we need more typologies, we need more risk maps that can be developed. Secondly, I think we need to improve regulation in this area, and we need to enforce leadership. Now, we have seen an excellent example of leadership on the political level, and I think that can be piled up with leadership also in the financial industry, among academia and civil society. So actually all the elements are there, the data is there. These financial transactions do happen, they are documented, but I think we're not yet good enough in actually using and exploiting that intelligence to turn it into action. And thirdly, because this business is to be seen at a global stage, this business is crossing borders. So a single country alone will not be able to resolve that. And I think that's also the basic idea behind the Global Fund, which is an excellent initiative. The same must be replicated when you look at the financial transactions relating to modern slavery. So there's still a lot to do in terms of access to financial data, but also sharing of financial data. We still have a number of barriers that do not allow, for example, financial institutions to share the information. And again, there are a number of good examples. US Patriot Act has provisions that actually give safeguards and safe harbors for financial institutions if they want to collaborate. So there's a huge potential. And last but not least, the role of civil society is instrumental here. And we have that situation that there are so many excellent civil society organizations working on the ground, helping victims of modern slavery. They all gather information that could be extremely useful. What we haven't managed yet is actually to make that available to financial institutions. But again, there are institutions around that work on this. I hate to single out a civil society organization because there are so many doing good work, but if you have a chance to look at the work of Liberty Asia, it's well documented, they have tremendous expertise in the area, and that can be something, again, that can be replicated in other parts of the world. So what we are considering now in Liechtenstein and beyond is to set up a multi-stakeholder financial sector, call it task force, that will coordinate all these actions. So the ideas are around. Funding is something that can be generated, as we have seen a good example here, if there is political leadership. And there is, and I guess I've been doing that business in regulation for the last 30 years. So we have come across situations where we disagreed with the financial industry and where we disagreed with NGOs, and usually the financial industry thought we are doing too much and the NGOs thought we're not doing enough. But on that topic, we're actually all in the same boat. And we actually think more needs to be done, and this is a unique opportunity. So I think having know what the problem is, we have no excuse not to act upon it.
Daniel, thank you. That was a really terrific overview of the potential for financial tools to be used to really address the scourge of modern slavery. I wanted to ask you about the potential unintended consequences. So you mentioned the relationship to counterterrorism and also civil society. I think one of the things that we've explored is the fact that the more effective the international community has been at using financial tools to address money laundering by terrorist groups, the more that they've actually turned to human smuggling and human trafficking as a way of increasing their revenues. Similarly, we've seen that some of these financial tools have been used by governments in a way to sort of shut down civil society organizations or have led to a lot of people being unbanked in the developing world. And the best practices that financial institutions are adopting and exploring to address this issue, how are you thinking about managing those potential downsides or unintended consequences?
And true, they are here. And that should not have happened, and yeah, it has happened. And we shouldn't close our eyes to that. Certainly nobody wanted to have that. It was an unintended consequence. And it's probably an example where we should better think of better regulation rather than more regulation and more pressure on financial institutions, especially in the area where actually financial institutions are willing to contribute. I don't think the starting point should be more and more regulation, which actually has that consequence. The financial institution will say, look, if you put all the blame on us and all the responsibility, the only thing we can do is close down the business and not to serve anyone in a given region or in a given business. Yeah. So I think we, the international community, we realize that, that there's a higher understanding of the negative consequences of what is called de-risking or de-marketing, as it probably would rather be. And in the Council of Europe body I work in Moneyval, we're trying to address this. The region, especially in Eastern Europe, has been massively affected by that. So indeed, yes, there's high recognition that this is an unintended consequence. And we really have to think of and look at the regulation again. What burden do we actually place on financial institutions? What is still doable and where do we go too far? So maybe a good opportunity also to review the setup that we have chosen 15 years ago.
Mm. And like you said, maybe it is also about this multi-sectoral and multi-stakeholder effort where civil society is a part of the conversation from the beginning so that everybody is jointly thinking through how this might all play out, the upsides and the downsides, right? I want to bring Jen into this conversation. So a lot of these different networks come together in Africa, particularly in the Sahel, where you have organizations that are trafficking weapons, drugs, foreign fighters, and also human beings using some of the same networks and migratory routes. I was hoping you could talk to us a little bit about kind of the intersection of all of these criminal and terrorist networks in the Sahel and how trafficking plays into this nexus.
Yeah, I think it goes to the point a little bit of the difficulty of unintended consequences. Mm. If you attack one aspect of the traffic and the criminal economy in which trafficking is embedded, it manifests itself elsewhere. You know, human trafficking is probably the most cruel manifestation of this, but there are so many other traffic products, narcotics, arms, drugs, people smuggling, which is often kind of overlaps with the trafficking networks, all fueling a political economy in which competition and rivalry over routes and safe havens and zones of influence often feeds into militancy and into extremism. So there are extremist groups who may be funded by drug traffickers looking to secure routes, for example. And so there's sometimes a direct link between traffickers and extremist groups, but there are often kind of symbiotic relationships among them. I mean, the Upper Sahel, for centuries, trans-Saharan trade has been the lifeblood of communities living there in this vast space. You know, traditional commodities now are shipped by air and by sea. Borders meant that, you know, smuggling and evading taxes became the big criminal issue. But as the traditional commodities became less and less able to be traded, trafficking has become really the most lucrative industry and one of the few viable industries in the Sahara and the Northern Sahel. And so to try to eliminate one element of this, you risk turning people to another element or moving back and forth among them. A couple of things is, other direct effects are, depending on the model of trafficking, occasionally a trafficked person will have an entire journey paid for. Occasionally, you'll be handed off in segments from one route to the next. There are often nodes like Agadez is one of them, or Gao, that are transit and connection hubs. At times, people will run out of money and not be able to take the further route on, or abandoned by their traffickers. And those people become particularly vulnerable to recruitment into sexual slavery or into extremist groups and so forth. So there's a great deal of overlap in both the victims and the financiers of this. And then finally, the extremist groups themselves in impressing young men into service, in kidnapping women into sexual slavery and sexual servitude, and are direct contributors and as well. And I was glad to hear the senator talk about how do you ultimately care for those who have been victimized as a big part of the initiative. Because I think in Nigeria, for example, where I've worked a great deal, there's a fair amount of attention on the Chibok girls who gained international attention, but there are thousands and thousands of other young women who have not gotten that same kind of psychosocial support and reintegration.
So Jen, in the way that you described it, there are all of these overlapping networks. And as you said, if you deal with just one slice of it, then you can push people into the other networks. And the way that the international community and their local partners are dealing with these challenges, do they see it as a holistic challenge, or do you see an approach where certain actors are dealing just with terrorism, or dealing just with weapons smuggling, or dealing just with human smuggling?
I mean, if you talk to people on the ground in a place like Gao, they're not, when attacks occur, they're not sure who's who, and they see people morph from one group to another and put on one hat one day and another hat the other day. But the international community comes in and says, okay, the UN is going to deal with the political actors here. The French, through Operation Barkhane, are going to deal with the terrorist actors, not seeing the connection among them. And then there's some emphasis and some integration of the trafficking factors, but it is seen as a much less pressing priority and is dealt with in some ways peripherally to the central problem. So, I think the international community has categories and roles that do not always fit on the ground where things are much more fluid and flexible. The other thing is the incentives of states and governments in the region to tackle this problem. First of all, this doesn't happen without collusion from local and so often national authorities, who are getting kickbacks or directly involved or getting bribed at the border and so forth. And a failure to tackle that is, you're not going to be able to stop this. On the other hand, again, it's kind of a lifeblood for a lot of, you know, customs, border, and national, you know, national politicians. Mm-hmm. Very few see a strong incentive to really securitize the vast reaches in which this trafficking can take place. It's not there. It's not highly populated. A whole bunch of votes don't come from there. The only money that does come from there is kickbacks from the criminal trade. So how do you get the states, these very vulnerable states, who even with the best intentions are going to have a very difficult time monitoring, tracking, who have judicial systems that are unable to process this, and the investigative and prosecutorial capacities are missing, when, as Senator Corker says, we have this in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the financial institutions are probably way behind in being able to track this. And again, the incentive structures for these states to build those institutional, investigatorial and prosecutorial capacities is very low.
Yeah. So Daniel, given your work on anti-corruption, I wanted to bring you back in on this last point. As Jen mentioned, oftentimes there are incentive structures in place that actually prevent governments from having a full forced effort to address trafficking of persons. When we were in Djibouti, a lot of government interlocutors admitted that they knew who the traffickers were, but these people relied on this trade in order to make a living. And if they really went after them, if they prosecuted them, then they would have some rather influential people who were jobless and didn't have sort of means of supporting themselves, which would become a problem for the government. So again, focused on solutions and actions, how do you build incentives for government officials to go after the financial underpinnings of trafficking?
I don't remember when it was, I think 2006, in a country called Georgia, in the Caucasus, when the Rose Revolution occurred. And there was a very courageous president at the time. He changed that later on, but at the time, he was very courageous and had a very strong anti-corruption agenda. And they had exactly the same phenomenon on the street. You know, everybody said, how can we stop this? Because we live on it. Mm-hmm. Police was totally corrupt. But when you were driving or on the roads, every 5 miles you would pay $1. And he sounds like, look, you can do that for another week. I give you 1 week time. If any policeman is still taking bribes after 1 week, you'll be fired. Everybody laughed about it. Everybody heard that about various instances from people coming to government. But he was serious about it. So he fired 16,000 policemen. Now, you couldn't believe every single international expert cautioned against this. Every ambassador came to say, this will end up in chaos and this will not work. And what happened? It worked. Certainly, there was a lot of preparation on that. They built up, in the meantime, a 2,000 head police force. Somebody funded it, the US government at the time. So they had an alternative in place. And out of a sudden, people realized, well, it's actually possible. Mm. And people tried to continue to bribe, and they were very surprised to actually see a policeman saying, no, go on, move on. I'm actually interested in, you know, the safety of your car and not my personal income. So there are examples where it happened, and I think it takes leadership from the top to do that. I wouldn't think we have to talk people on the ground say, well, you have to change your behavior because it's ethically not fair and you shouldn't do that. That will never work. Of course it's not fair and it's not correct, and everybody knows that. And I think there's no culture in the world that actually accepts slavery. That's not the issue. Right. I don't think we have to address this as a cultural issue. Yeah. Mm. So it's sometimes it takes a revolution.
Hmm. Great. Well, I would like to take some questions from the audience. We will have staff passing mics around. So please, when you stand up to ask a question, let us know who you are, where you come from. If you have an institutional affiliation, please keep your question to an actual question, and we'll take as many questions as we can in the time that we have. Right here in the back.
Hi, good morning. My name is Martina Vandenberg. I'm from the Human Trafficking Legal Center, and I was actually at the Grace Farms event. It's good to see you again. I wanted to ask about progress on using suspicious activity reports provided to Treasury and to law enforcement in actually identifying trafficking cases. I think that's one of the mysteries, because American banks, for example, have been submitting suspicious activity reports, but there's no feedback to the to civil society about the level of success that you've seen.
Great. Any questions on this side? We can take a few at a time. The mic's coming.
Ambassador Lichtenstein, I want to ask you, Daniel, a question. It's broadly discussed in a different context in the financial community, but how much a challenge is you think is the possibility of circumventing traditional financial instruments to execute payments? I mean, bartering and Bitcoin and all this stuff. I mean, of course, at one point I expect there will be regulations in place to address these alternative means, but we're not there yet. How much of a problem is it already? These people already anticipating that and operating heavily through those channels, or are they still waiting and might react later on?
Great questions. Ms. Hark?
Yeah, good to see you again. Hi. You'd be very happy to hear that a lot of follow-up action has occurred since our meeting at Grace Farms. And to address your specific question, I would not know on a national level what exactly happened with the SARS at FinCEN here in the US or in Canada, but what we know is as a result of their activity and awareness raising, the number of SARS certainly went up. I wouldn't know about exactly what percentage of that were turned into investigations, but that is something that we are currently exploring at two levels. One is more at the policy level at the Financial Action Task Force. I'm about to fly to Buenos Aires tonight, where we have a meeting where a working group has been set up to look at this issue. There's a lot of input now coming from countries. There will be policy recommendations of what could be done more. There may be typologies coming out of that process. So that's something that goes beyond now the national level into the global level. And also the Egmont Group of Financial Intelligence Units, so the global body that will bring the financial intelligence together, has restarted work on human trafficking to far better understand what the role of these financial intelligence units can be. So there's a lot of focus on that. We haven't seen anything like that before. I don't know exactly what the tangible outcome is, and we have to keep track of that. I very much like Senator Corker to ask for measurable results, and that's something we have to keep in mind. So paper is nice, but it's also very patient, and nothing will happen just because we draft a paper. So thanks for that input. I hope if we continue that dialogue, there will be more tangible results on that, because that's essential at the end. Ambassador Jaeger question, yes, of course, criminals will always try to bypass the formal channels. And the best way to bypass formal payment channels is still cash. Now, cash is still king. But then again, cash is also expensive, and the large, the larger an organization would be, the more they will depend also on formal channels. So sooner or later, they'll probably come into the area of financial transactions. Not necessarily banking. I think the non-banking sector, especially the remittance sector, plays an important role here. But we do see a lot of alternatives coming up. And currently the debate, I think when the debate started on these cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin and others, was we don't want that, so we write a law to say it's not allowed, it's illegal. That was the typically first reaction of regulators. We don't understand it, so we don't want it. And I think this has shifted into well, wait a second, it will happen anyway, whether we like it or not. And it will happen because it's effective, it's cheaper, it's technology will always win at the end of the day. So I think the debate we're having now is how to bring in these players into the regulated area, but have a tailor-made regulation for them that fits for them, which is probably not the same. They can also address issues that concerns that you brought up. I think these kind of technologies where they have certain risks and threats, they also create huge opportunities. For example, to bank people that have not been banked in the past. Mobile payments in Africa is a great success story. And I think measures have been taken to mitigate the risks associated with it. So my position would be not to be negative about that, to encompass it, to bring in the major players, to actually reward those that are willing to accept a certain degree of regulation, but not to strangulate them so they can't operate anymore.
And Jen, within a context like Africa, where, as you mentioned, a lot of countries don't have a high capacity to deal with the multitude of issues that they're facing and the overlapping issues, much less really technical issues in terms of identifying suspicious transactions and doing something about it. What do you think it would require to have African countries on the front line be able to tackle human trafficking using financial tools more effectively?
Well, that on the financial tool side, that's tricky, and the capacities vary from country to country as well. And I think there are, Kenya, for example, has gotten much more sophisticated in financial, and the mobile money issue is another one. I mean, I wonder in a context of a Niger or a Mali, how much the financial institutions are going to be the tool to do it. And I think they're really incentivizing the government to begin to build the institutions is one. Two, connecting with communities through which this traffic occurs and finding civil society champions and community champions who can at least get the ball rolling in terms of informing and connecting with security, law enforcement as well, and strengthening law enforcement and judicial services. On money laundering, I know there are efforts, and the African Development Bank and the World Bank are trying to kind of strengthen the capacity of governments and financial institutions. But for some of those countries, that's a very long way to go. And I wonder, and I'm not an expert in the human trafficking arena, but if it's a very dispersed trade in some ways, that you don't have the critical mass of funds that are going to raise red flags along the value chain.
Other questions? Right here.
Lindsay Holliday from Karma US Partners. My question, following up on what you just said, is since so many women and girls go willingly with strange men to and then end up in these situations, how much public outreach is there at the community level in these rural areas to teach women and girls to protect themselves?
Well, there's one more question. We'll take two. Yep, this gentleman right here.
Hi, my name is my name is Zach. I wanted to ask about incentivizing reforms of corrupt practices. So there's a large role that external pressure can play on these countries, but at what point do, as the US, do they worry in terms of their foreign policy that they may be pushing them, these countries, towards Russia or China? And where does the line get drawn as to when the risk becomes worth it anyway?
I think there's a big role to play in terms of awareness raising and so forth. You have kind of nodes of, Benin City in Nigeria, in Edo State, has been a source of thousands of young women trafficked into Europe, often leaving voluntarily. And then only to discover, we don't have a route back, but sending remittances back. I mean, there's some, and in fact, getting collusion from family and others within Binance City as they see the revenues. So there's a lot to be done to kind of change minds within the communities themselves. That has also a lot to do with kind of emphasizing the value of women, and rather than, I mean, there is collaboration in sending these women off to kind of unknown futures. So I think there are some issues of how do you emphasize the value of women, prevent them from traveling off with the hope that you get remittances at the other end. So there's a great deal of education to be done within communities, and the dangers of the travel, the uncertainty of the eventual payback, and perhaps, you know, strengthen the communication between the young women who leave and their home base. I'm not sure that enough is being done on that, and in terms of how does a young woman who finds herself in this situation, where does she reach out to what authority along the way?
A hard question for me. Yes, of course. I think for any issue, if the driver is only one country, and if that country happens to be a very large country, there will be an assumption that this is maybe done for political reasons, and, you know, we better don't join that, or we do it just but not generally. I think the broader coalition is against modern slavery. The less we would have that again unwanted effect that somebody would be pushed into the hands of somebody else. And I do see, I mean, if you deal with money laundering, you have to be like Sisyphus, if you're familiar with that Greek methodology, and you have to believe that Sisyphus is a very happy person. So I'm an optimist. So I would believe that on that issue we have a potential to bring in major players. So it's not only driven by one large country or the U.S. in particular. But I'm not sure whether in the context of Africa that is something that we should be careful about. I simply wouldn't know.
Well, you do think of major global campaigns that change the discourse about something, like female genital mutilation, for example. Once, you know, okay, we shouldn't touch that, we shouldn't talk about that, to something that, you know, there has been a tipping point within Africa in terms of seeing this as something very undesirable. There are other, and even on polio or on HIV/AIDS, once you create a global critical mass, you can change the incentives. You get civil society within those countries galvanized on this, who then also put pressure. You know, in Nigeria, the return of the girls, I mean, from the hands of Boko Haram, you know, does that kind of move a new dialogue on this? So I don't think it's impossible, and I think it may take a while, but, you know, a critical mass moves forward, and then kind of the trailers eventually get pressure to come along. So
if there aren't any more questions, I would like you to join me in thanking the panelists, Daniel and Jennifer, for sharing their insights with us. And thank you to you and the audience for participating in something that really is a very important issue that doesn't get nearly enough attention given the human devastation that's caused and the scope of it. And finally, a big thank you to Liechtenstein for partnering with us on this event and really putting a spotlight for a couple hours on the issue of human slavery. So thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another curated conversation from CSIS. Tune in next week for more, and remember, you can explore all of our events online at csis.org.